This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When Sandra Lawson received ordination from Reconstructionist Rabbinical College in 2018, she became the first openly gay black female rabbi in the world. Her story began in Missouri, in a military Christian family. She spent years in the military herself before converting to Judaism and studying to work as a rabbi. Rabbi Sandra is now Associate Chaplain for Jewish Life at Elon University and joins me now on the State of Things. Rabbi Sandra, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It really means a lot to be on the show.
Well, it means a lot to have you here, and tell us about your journey. Well, let's start with where you are right now. I mean, obviously a big year of changes for all of us. It's day to day on Elon's campus for you in the midst of this pandemic. What's life like for you, and what are you doing?
Well, thankfully, I'm actually in my office, Elon's campus at the Sklut Hillel Center. I say it that way because for a long time, especially during the spring and summer, we were all working remotely. The campus reopened and students came back to campus and we're, you know, working in our offices, albeit like socially distanced. And our student centers are not as lively as they used to be, but we are constantly trying to find new and innovative ways to engage with our students.
Well, let's talk about that. Two big Jewish holy days in September, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. How did that go? How did that go for you?
You know, what's interesting is that, the entire religious community, so Christians, Jews, Muslims, we were all trying to figure it out. I mean, we all come from traditions, and I know I left some religious traditions out, but the ones that I know the most about are Christians and Muslims. But we were all, trying to figure it out, and we all come from faith traditions where it's so important that we gather for celebrations, we gather for grief, we gather for joy, and we couldn't do that anymore. One of the things that I was really grateful for is that clergy all over the world, where we were all helping each other, trying to figure that out. It started with Passover for Jews, Easter for Christians, and Muslims had their holidays. And then when we came back to campus, we had to figure out how to do Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and those are not just two services. There's a lot of religious observances that happen, you know, during Rosh Hashanah, in between Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and then Yom Kippur. And one of the things that our team realized that we needed to do was that we sort of gave ourselves permission to not necessarily celebrate the ways that we normally would, and to do it not necessarily in a reform way or a reconstructionist way, but in an Elon way. And our student leaders were really awesome with that. And we had one, our religious chair really did a lot of organizing to get student buy-in so that we could have an amazing celebratory services, most of them online. And it was the most student participatory high holiday services that we have ever had since I've been here, and that was great.
Well, I'd love to know what that looks like, because in a way that intersects with another big change that had been going on before the pandemic, and that is the way in which young people receive and understand religion and their participation in religion. That's been changing, and I wonder all of that then is reflected in what you just said, which is that students now have taken a greater role in organizing the worship.
Yeah, and I think that, COVID was sort of a blessing when it came to student participation, because they realized that we could create something different. And the message that I said to them and our team was that we were making history. We were showing the world that celebrating our holidays was more important than not. So we had to find a way to do it. We couldn't just say, we're not going to do it. Our students really stepped up, and we created a service that still followed most of the traditions, but we inserted a lot of stuff in our liturgy to reflect the times we were in. I mean, I couldn't be the rabbi and just ignore the fact that COVID was happening. I couldn't ignore the fact that people were protesting in the streets. So we added all of that with an incredibly diverse Jewish student body to bring voices to how they were feeling and that they also wanted to celebrate. And we had amazing song leaders that sang our prayers, and it was great. For me, it was just, you know, it wasn't the same, but it was in many ways kind of better.
Was there a point at which, and you talk about it being better and a blessing, but when you go into a process like this, knowing that to some extent, as the rabbi, you are responsible for the history and the tradition. This is the reason we have rabbis and we call it a religion, right?
Yeah.
So is there a moment where you say, I have to watch to make sure, you can't go over there. You can't go there. This takes it too far. This takes it too far outside of
what I did, and I can only speak for what I did here. I can't speak for other rabbis, of course, is that I crafted an outline of a service. And then I shared it with my partner, and his name is Boaz Avram Katz. And then we shared it with our student leaders. So our student leaders, okay, fine, I can get students to do these parts. And then I crafted a service, that stuck to tradition, but also recognized where we were in our society. And then I, again, showed it to students so that we could get buy-in from students. And then when students were like, we're not comfortable with this, or I don't know a song for this, or I don't know a prayer for this, and then I would say, like, okay, tell me, these are the themes for this prayer. Tell me what you can sing. Tell me a song that you know. And then we would insert their voices that way. But definitely, and I created a whole new, I'll call it a script, you can call it a prayer book, for everyone to follow that was not in, you know, it was our own prayer book for our services.
Well, I want to talk more about that later, too, because I think perhaps many of our non-Jewish listeners might not know is that Judaism is somewhat famous for adapting scripture to the times to make sure that it's always fitting the way we're living here, because this relationship with God meant we're here doing this. You've got your job. Let's work this out together in the current moment. I want to talk more about that, but actually right now I want to see how you got there, because you've worked at Elan for almost 2.5 years, but let's rewind the clock. You grew up in a Christian family. So what was your faith experience like there?
So I grew up, I want to modify that a bit. I grew up with parents that were Christian, but I didn't grow up in a Christian house. Like, I understand now that we were Christians, but we didn't do the things that Christians do, except that occasionally we would go to church. Both of my parents, my mom recently passed away, later in life, did identify as Christian, and my dad grew up in a strong Christian household. But for reasons that I don't really understand, they decided that that would not be a central part of our upbringing. And I've talked to my dad, his response is, oh, that was your mother's idea. So my mother's passed away, so I don't really know why they did that. I did go to church, like if we were invited by friends, but I didn't understand Christianity. I didn't understand anything about Christianity outside of the Jesus birth narrative. And so I have never seen myself as a Christian. And I understand now that the default religion in our society is Christian, because we live in a Christian-centric society. So the only religion that I had any concept of was Christian.
What about the community itself? Did you feel comfortable there? Was there a sense of the community outside of the whatever the religious doctrine might have been that made you feel comfortable?
Yeah, I didn't. Like, when I, you know, one, like, my mom used to say that I was too smart for my britches. I was that kid that spent a lot of time in the library. So I knew that on some level that the people who fought and marched and died, some of them died in the civil rights movement, had strong faith. Were deeply Christian and centered in their religious practices, but I didn't have any of that. And when I did go to church, my experience of it as a young emerging lesbian or young emerging queer person, which I say it that way because I don't think I was quite aware at that time, I saw when we went to church, I saw Christian leaders be homophobic, be sexist, and I didn't like that. And to me, that was Christianity, and I didn't want any part of it. And when I would ask my mother about it, because my mother, very strong feminist ideology, I remember her talking to me about the Equal Rights Amendment, the Women's Equal Rights Amendment, and why that didn't pass, and her being upset about it. You know, but I would ask her, like, why do we go to these churches when they're sexist and homophobic? And she's like, oh, you just take the good stuff and you use the bad stuff. That was nice.
Was there good stuff for you? Was there kind of an impulse toward a deeper faith, a deeper understanding that perhaps you recognized wasn't happening in this church?
You're breaking up again.
Sorry. I'm asking if there was a yearning for something deeper, a faith. I mean, there's two ways you can go. One is to say, this is a lot of nonsense, I'm leaving. One is to say, I need something deeper and they're not giving it to me.
I don't think so. I mean, I think that I don't think I thought of it that way. I think today I probably would have, but I just saw it as was something I didn't need. And granted, I didn't know there were other options at the time. Mm. And I just was like, I don't want any part of this. I don't like it. And that changed when I took a course on, I guess it was called the Old Testament or the Five Books of Moses or whatever, in college. And that treated the Bible as a piece of literature and gave me access. And that was like the first time where any religion seemed accessible to me. I still wasn't trying to be religious, but it was like, oh, this is Bible is a book with history. And it was a perspective that I hadn't heard before.
We'll talk about the way that perspective changed the life of Rabbi Sandra Lawson. Just ahead, find out about those events that led finally to her conversion to Judaism and her rabbinical education. And we'll talk about it on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Rabbi Sandra Lawson didn't always have her career sights set on being a leader in the Jewish faith. She started college without a clear path, and she ended up joining the military. A series of jobs and further education honed her passions for advocacy and community and took her eventually to rabbinical school. Rabbi Sandra is currently Associate Chaplain for Jewish Life at Elon University and my guest today. So let's talk about that, because you said it was opening those books in college that led to a different understanding about what religion can be. But tell us about college. What were you doing in college? Where were you expecting to go?
Yeah, so when I entered college after high school, like most people do, and I went to what was called Northeast Missouri State. It's now Truman State University in Kirksville, Missouri. And I really had no plan. You know, my parents didn't take the traditional path to their college degrees, and I didn't really have a model. I just knew that was what I was supposed to do. And my parents were having a really hard time in their relationship and in their marriage, which then made it hard that I was having a hard time. And so I couldn't focus. And, you know, I loved being in college, but I was not doing well in college. And so I dropped out and I went home, and that wasn't a good place because, like I said, my parents were not having the best relationship. And so an option for me to join the military, to have the military pay off my college loans, seemed like a good idea. So I joined the military.
You did? It was military police, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was great. And military, you know, I often tell people the three best decisions I made in my life were, one, joining the military, marrying my wife, and being ordained. Joining the military gave me a plan. It taught me how to accomplish goals. It taught me how to reach for things that I want. And how to backwards plan so that I can have anything that I wanted. And I'm not sure I would have those skills today if I had not joined the military.
You did that, and you left. So what happened when you left?
Well, when I left, by the time I left, I had finished, while I was in the military, I finished the semester that I had left of college, and wanted to get a master's and eventually a PhD in sociology, because I got an undergraduate degree in sociology and really loved the field and saw myself becoming an academic, becoming a professor of sociology. But in the meantime, when I got out of the military, what happens with a lot of people when they get out of the military is the last thing they want to do is want to work for somebody, because you've been taking orders for however many years and you want more flexibility. And so an opportunity arose where I started a personal training business. and I started a personal training business and loved that too. I learned, used a lot of the skills that I learned while I was in the military, and sort of put a pause on getting a master's degree in sociology. And finally, some of my clients, after almost like 10 years, were like, you're never going to get that master's degree. And I was like, yes, I am. I am, I am, I am. And so I finally did. And I got a master's degree from Clark Atlanta University with the plan to get a PhD afterwards. But during that time period, I felt this weird pull, as we were talking beforehand, like sort of Moses felt this pull to turn to the bush, and God had asked him to do things that didn't necessarily make sense to him.
Right.
I felt this pull to go to rabbinical school, which I thought was just weird to me at the time, because I didn't think that that was something I should do. And I had no plan for it. Like, I had a plan, a charted path to get a PhD in sociology. I knew exactly what that road looked like. I didn't know the road for being a Black queer rabbi.
Right. When you're tending your flocks out of Egypt and everything is going well, who needs to hear about plan to go someplace that you was just not on your radar? We'll talk about, because part of that was prompted to some degree by a meeting, a business connection that you made as a trainer, right?
Yeah. My friend, who I love very dearly, his name is Joshua Lester. He's a rabbi in Atlanta. He's a rabbi for Congregation Beit HaBarim, which means House of Friends. And, you know, it's so weird how the universe works. He hired me as his personal trainer, and we've been friends since then. That was like, I don't know, year 2000, 2001, and has a lot to do with where I am today and how I see my Judaism. It has a lot to do with his role as my rabbi, his role as my friend, and that congregation that I came from in Atlanta.
Well, tell us more about that experience then in going to that congregation.
You know, it's interesting. It's kind of funny. Like, I often tell people, like, when I was in college, I woke up one day and all my friends were gay. Like, I didn't realize they were all gay, and then I came out. Before I converted to Judaism, for some reason, all my friends were Jewish. And so today, I'm not only Jewish, I'm a rabbi. So it's just kind of interesting that way. Mm. So, you know, my friend Josh, as friends do, you know, invited me to his synagogue for, I think it was Hanukkah, which is the next holiday that's on our calendar. And, you know, I think on one hand, he invited me because I'm his friend. And on the other hand, I know that I was asking him a lot of questions. And I think maybe one way for me to get those answers was to be invited to a service. And I'm an introvert. And even though I can perform as an extrovert and I love speaking in front of people, it's kind of weird when you're invited somewhere as an introvert and the person who invites you is busy. So that means I had to figure out how to like keep myself from freaking out.
But you've got to introduce yourself to people. And they know you're not, you know, because they don't recognize you. You're not there every week. So who are you, right?
Yeah. But the interesting thing is that... Because the synagogue is not in the suburbs, it's in the city of Atlanta, at least where it was at that time. It still is, but it was more, it's a synagogue in the city. And many of the synagogues at the time were in the suburbs. And so people were very, very nice to me, very warm to me, very welcoming. And I asked Josh, Why would everybody, I clearly don't look like I belong there. And he said, because, you know, I think he said something like, because we're in the city, we're sort of used to people just sort of coming in to check us out. And so in that way, I didn't seem so unusual. And a lot of people that I would see at, you know, protest or activist work were members of that community. And so I saw people that I kind of loosely knew.
Mm-hmm.
And also when I got to the synagogue, there was like these latkes, it was like a latke contest or whatever. And, they had the latke contest, people were eating latkes, and then they went to the sanctuary to sit and watch the service. So I went to the sanctuary, and this is how I remember that whole thing happening. So there was this like, people were eating their latkes in the sanctuary. There was a helper dog, Chance, who since passed away, who was sort of helping himself to the crumbs of people.
These are forgive me for interrupting, but these are potato pancakes, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
And people were adjusting themselves so the dog could get the crumbs. And my friend Josh was doing his thing up there, preaching and talking and praying. And then there were kids that were like dancing in the aisles to the music, to the songs. And in some ways, when I described this to some members or some people, they think it sounds chaotic. And I said, no, actually, it was very refreshing because it showed me that everybody in that community was getting what they needed. Hmm. The dog was getting what he needed. The children were like doing their thing so the parents could sit there and pray and parents didn't have to worry about the children. And then the last part was this prayer, the most inclusive prayer that I'd ever heard in any religious community. There was a prayer called the prayer for the end of hiding. And at the time, it started off with we as gay and lesbian Jews and was asking for a world where we can be our full selves instead of having to hide who we are. And I was just like, wow. And I just kept going back.
And I wonder at the time, you know, you can sort of imagine I've got this friend. I'm a little bit curious about what's going on there. Hey, why don't you come on and check it out? And so you do. You have this experience. To what extent were some of the religious questions that you talked about, the fact that when you were in college, you took a look at the Pentateuch and said, wow, there's something going on here. You know, how much of that was swirling about at the time, or was it not yet? Did it not yet sort of become present?
Well, I didn't even understand the language. Like, this is not
right.
A place where there was a lot of English being thrown around. And I mean, there was, but like all the songs were in Hebrew. All the prayers were in Hebrew. And so I would just sort of, if I looked at the prayer book, would just maybe look at the translations, but I don't even remember looking at the prayer book. I remember spending a lot of time looking around. Later on, of course, I did pay more attention to the prayer book. But like some of those like religious, like the concerns that I had about religion weren't really an issue. I just kind of liked being there and I would just keep going back. And then at some point I realized that, in order for me to have all the rights and privileges, responsibilities, whatever, of being a member, that I would need to convert.
What was that process then like for you? First of all, that decision, you've given us some insight, and then the process, this conversion process.
Well, you know, I can only speak for myself, but like I met with my friend Josh. I remember I asked him for lunch. It was Christmas Eve. And I said, you know, I'm thinking about converting to Judaism, but I only want to do with you. And if that's a problem, then I don't want to do it. Because I was concerned that it was like some kind of, you know, like maybe he shouldn't convert his friend, or I'm not sure what I thought. But he's like, oh, no, it's not a problem at all. And, you know, we had a conversation about like the larger world of Judaism, not just converting to Beit HaPerim. So I took classes at the local JCC, the local Jewish Community Center. And also Josh was my workout partner. So I had regular meetings with him every morning at like 6 o'clock in the morning. And other times too. And sometimes I would say to him like, okay, I need your rabbi hat on. I don't understand this. Or, I would definitely distinguish between, you know, when I wanted to talk to his friends and when I would have Jewish questions. And we also met in his office too, but I had regular access to him on a daily basis where I could process any of my concerns about Judaism.
Were some of those, you know, some of the ways in which we might think about Judaism is because it has ancient roots, we think about its deep cultural roots, and it tends not to be an apostolic religion. In other words, it doesn't seem to be looking for converts in the way that we know that Christianity has operated. Did you have the sense that, well, no, really, you need to grow up in this tradition in order to convert? You can't just sort of understand the doctrine? Or how did you navigate that question?
It wasn't really a question, I think, because looking back, this congregation, Beit HaPerim, was a congregation founded by people who were on the margins of Judaism. It was founded by gays and lesbians who did not feel welcomed in other Jewish spaces at the time. And you have to go back to understanding the age crisis and what that was like. And they wanted to be gay and Jewish. They didn't want to be Jewish and leave their gayness checked at the door. So they created this community. And that very foundation of being radically welcoming to all you know, gay-founded synagogues are some of the first synagogues to welcome interfaith couples. Mm. We still have communities that find that to be a struggle. One, some of the first to welcome Jews of color. And so my entry into Judaism was never that this was some place that you couldn't convert into. It was the message to me was that all are welcome. Mm. It was later on, after I was like deeply in Judaism, where I realized, oh, not all communities are that welcoming.
Well, talk about it. Now, it's one thing to say you want to become a member and understand it more fully, to become Jewish, but then to become a rabbi.
Yeah, that's the crazy part. I'll admit it. That is the crazy part.
Well, fill us in. How did that happen? Yet another burning bush, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, so the Congregation of Beit HaVarim has amazing music. They write their own liturgy. They have it's very different Jewish music. I'll say that. And my wife has even said to me, like, oh, now I see why you don't like music in other synagogues, because it's just, the music is amazing. So I was very happy as a Black person in the pew of this predominantly white synagogue, singing and dancing and listening to music. I was happy there. And if you know anything about Jewish communities, at some point you're going to be asked to do something. You're going to be asked to volunteer for something. You're going to be asked to show up for something else, you know, or you're going to be asked to be on the board. And so my friend Josh, or someone, called me and said, we would like you to be on the board. And I was like, what? So I became like what was called, a representative at large. And so I was one of the people who was like, gave congregants access to the boards. If you had, you know, grievances, complaints, joys, you wanted to tell the board, you would pass. I had a group of congregants that would pass them to me, and then I would go to the board. And so that was like the first entry into leadership into a Jewish community. And so I was a representative at large, and eventually I became the vice president of the synagogue. The change as far as like becoming a rabbi, in 2004-ish, when the Supreme Court said that it was no longer illegal for gay people to have sex, really kind of how I interpret that. Mm-hmm. There was this mad rush in many states to change their state constitutions to ban same-sex marriage. And it's so weird because that was not that long ago, and we've come so far since then. But I found myself with a lot of other activists in Atlanta trying to figure out how to fight this. We were just happy that we weren't going to go to jail. And now we found ourselves on the defensive trying to like stop a constitutional amendment that we didn't even think we needed. And so I did some training with some other activists in Atlanta. And I worked with organizers, and I found it to be very toxic. I thought I liked politics, but I didn't. Mm. The whole like conversations about, you know, gay people being evil or whatever toxic language just thrown around. Even within my own communities, I was like, I just don't like this. But because many religious leaders wanted a diverse coalition of Jewish leaders, so in that time, it really meant Christians and Jews. We weren't talking about other people because that was the world we lived in. Mm-hmm. I was invited at the clergy table because they wanted more Jewish representation. And the only Jewish representation that I ever saw in any of these meetings was my rabbi, Joshua Lesser. Many of the other rabbis were not present for these conversations. Many Jewish communities were absent. Again, very different world. Now we live in a world where rabbis want to get arrested. this is just a very different world. And by sitting at the clergy table and having the same sort of conversations, I found that even though I was having the same conversations that I was having in those toxic spaces, it was actually healthier for me in the sense that I found that the clergy, even if we disagree, we are sort of pre-wired to find common ground, to find some place where we can agree and then build from there instead of constantly focusing on what we disagree with. And I really liked that. And I started doing more interfaith work. And then I realized that, you know, if I'm going to continue this, I need to either have the letters rabbi in front of my name or the letters PhD behind my name. And the PhD route as a Jewish academic was not something I wanted. And I started thinking about going to medical school so I could do more interfaith work and have the power of the title behind me.
So you attended Reconstructionist Rabbinical College in Pennsylvania, school there for 6 years. Give us a sense. I'm coming up against a break here, but maybe you can get us started with a look at the stages of your education.
Yeah, so the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, I can't speak for other schools, but it's centered on the civilizations of Judaism. And so the education is, you know, you spend a good chunk of your time, well, first for me, language acquisition, I had to learn another language. And then you spend a good time with the history of the Bible. And then you move to the history of rabbinics. And these are all particular time periods in Jewish history. So you spend a semester with each time period so that you can understand Jewish history. And that's the approach that the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College takes to learning Jewish history.
Well, we'll talk about how that all turned out when my conversation with Rabbi Sandra Lawson, Associate Chaplain for Jewish Life at Elon University, continues on The State of Things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Sandra Lawson became the first openly gay black female rabbi in the world in 2018, but it wasn't her first time being a leader in her community. Through music and writing and jobs like personal trainer and researcher for the Anti-Defamation League, Sandra has worked as an activist and an advocate. Rabbi Sandra is Associate Chaplain for Jewish Life and Jewish Educator at Elon University. We're talking about going to rabbinical school, and the work itself involves a lot of effort, also part of your training, right, to get out there and work. Tell us a little bit about the jobs that you held down during your studies. The Catholic Medical Center, right? You were also teaching. Tell us more about those.
Like the first job that I had as a rabbinical student was teaching Hebrew school, which is, you know, for like the low bar, but that's like the easiest job that you can get when you're really learning a lot. So synagogues that have schools really need and want rabbinical students to help teach schools. And so I worked at a few religious schools. And after about 2 years of doing that, I realized I didn't want to do that anymore.
Okay.
I just was not a demographic that I was good at. Mm. And also the structure of rabbinical schools, not rabbinical schools, Jewish day schools or Jewish schools, I kind of felt like they weren't, in my experience, that they weren't invested enough in language acquisition, like teaching kids to learn the language so that they can pray. Not to say they have to be fluent at it, but you need to have a better use of understanding of the language to really understand Judaism. I just felt like they weren't invested in that as a Hebrew teacher. So I was like, why am I here? And also teaching Hebrew school was also a way for me to get better at Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And then, it seems like so long ago, and, you know, because you spend all this time in rabbinical school and it's just like a huge part of your life and then it's just done. But I worked at an amazing, awesome, small conservative congregation that has always had rabbinical school students. And, I'm trying to remember Bristol Jewish Center in Bristol, PA, and they have had so many rabbinical students that there are rabbis now, some of them in their 70s, who were rabbis today because this congregation helped them to become better rabbis.
Wow.
And
finish that thought.
Yeah, I mean, and so they've now merged into another community because they were small and shrinking. But they're, you know, many of their members still follow me on social media and still root for me, and that's just amazing.
I wonder what it's like to be a convert in a rabbinical school in a seminary of sorts. I've always been curious about that because it seems to me that, again, if we're talking about the history, right, and the culture and the ways in which these prayers are meant to be, to some extent, you bring fresh eyes to this because if you're raised in that tradition, right, you're saying, well, yes, get on with it. Yes, I know that. And you're not. And I wonder if you had conversations with, sort of cradle Jews who were in rabbinical school saying, you know, this is what it means to me. And some eyes were opened in the process.
Yeah, most of those conversations I have with my teachers, not necessarily with my classmates. I say that because we talked about Jewish demographics. Many of my classmates, even whether they came to Judaism by accident of birth or they converted in later, were not often steeped in the same religious traditions that many of our teachers were. And so so many of my classmates had we all sort of had this struggle of, I'm clumsy here, but like lack of authenticity. Like, you know, we don't know enough. And we need to learn more because maybe maybe we converted in, or maybe we didn't go to synagogue or whatever. But that experience is almost universal with many Jews in America, where many Jews in America feel like they're not doing Judaism right. And one of the things that I want to do is that I want to show people that doing Judaism doesn't have to be complicated. You don't have to learn a ton of Hebrew. You don't have to pray in a foreign language. You don't have to do prayers a certain way. I mean, there is some order to things, but it shouldn't be so hard. Right. Like, you know, many people think that Shabbat is the holiday, the holiday that we have every week, the Sabbath, and it's complicated, but it really is quite easy. I know I got off topic, but...
Well, no, I think that's it. And I think also it shows that while the traditions are ancient in themselves, they're always sort of the moment and meant to be engaged in the moment. And I know that activism, for instance, is a big part of what you do now and in the past. And what does it mean to be an activist to you now in that role as rabbi?
Well, one of the things that I'm grateful for my education is that I sort of see myself as a carrier of our tradition. So I know what our tradition says, and I know which things I can change, and I know which things I can't. Or if I make some changes, I understand that. And so my role as a rabbi is to help people understand that Judaism can be your own. It doesn't have to be beholden to your grandparents' Judaism, or even my Judaism, for that matter. And that, you know, Judaism is this awesome thing that we have that is old, but it's old but not stale. And I really want to try to make it relevant and show that it's relevant today.
Well, and talk a little bit more about that, because I wonder what you've been doing this year to incorporate, say, news of protests or actions around Black Lives Matter into your work as a rabbi.
Yeah, so one of the first things was I added... liturgy. Well, we were talking about the High Holy Days. I borrowed a lot from the Reconstructing Judaism, the Reform Movement. I wanted to see what they were doing. And so I incorporated liturgy to talk about Black Lives Matter, to talk about the protests, to talk about COVID, to talk about injustice in our society. And today, you know, as a musician, like I'm a fellow with ISYC, the Interfaith Youth Corps, and I have a media project due every month. And so last month, I used a song that I wrote in 2015 after witnessing oppression from a group that wasn't mine. So I was in Israel, and I listened to the stories of Palestinians, and it broke my heart. So I went home and I wrote a song and cried when I played it for my roommate. And I put the song away. I didn't really think much about it. And then in this current state that we're living in, I pulled that song out again. And it had new life for me because it felt like it spoke to this moment. And it's a song about peace and wanting peace and the voices of marginalized people. And so my media project was I used that song, and I used images from a website called Unsplash, but the last part of the images in the video feature Jews of color, Black and brown Jews, giving them voices. Now, it doesn't say these are Jews, but Jews know that they're Jews.
Right. Well, but you have a media presence, too, a YouTube channel. Yeah. You disseminate this, distribute this widely, right, through various forms of digital media.
Yeah.
Which shouldn't be a surprise either. I mean, when you're the people of the book, people should remember that this is a remarkable and revolutionary use of a very new technology called writing, which was mostly used in contract law. And now here's the people saying, we're going to make a covenant with our very being So new technology, new communications technology, nothing new to the Jews.
Yeah. And also we're adapting to the technology of the time. I mean, you know, rabbis didn't just switch from their in-person services to do the same thing on Zoom. Rabbis are finding creative ways to use technology to preach their messages or to sing or to pray.
Did you, I know you talked about the song that you wrote, I think, after your visit to Israel, and then there was the Torah of the Blues, too. Can you tell us about that project?
So my project that I started before COVID and had this idea that I was going to look at a blues song every month and learn it. So I'm an avid learner, and my study of music is so that I could become a better musician. And I've always been attracted to blues music, like not like Stevie Ray Vaughan. Although Stevie Ray Vaughan was a very talented man, but like that old forgotten Delta blues, or even Piedmont blues for that matter, and that acoustic blues, that gut wrenching music that where you can hear the pain of people. And when I started looking at some of these songs, there was a lot of Torah in them, a lot of reference to the Old Testament, as a Christian would say, or a lot of references to some of the pain that exists in the history of the Jewish people. So I took, my plan was to take a song, learn the song, try to embody the song, which is important to me because when I first started playing blues or trying to play blues, and all honestly, I sounded like the Indigo Girls, which is, I love the Indigo Girls. I do, because that's what I listened to in college. But I tried to play the blues, but that's what came out. And now that I'm older, more experience under my belt, more pain, more heartache, more grief, whatever, I probably still sound a little bit like I'm influenced by the Indigo Girls, but I can embody the music that I've been listening to. And so I do plan to return to the project, because I think it's often a history that we kind of forget.
Yeah.
And it is the root of American music. And I'm also not trying to learn the songs that everybody knows. I'm trying to really take a deep dive. For example, one of the songs I was working on with one of my teachers is John Henry. We all know that song, John Henry, mm-hmm. John Henry, beat the steam mill. But that song is about slave labor. That song is about using prison labor and using labor so much that a man dies. And we just sort of gloss over that. And when I return to the project, that's probably the song I'm going to look at the next time.
Well, talk a little bit more about that, about uncovering the familiar, right? Like taking, like scraping away the familiar, because, you know, the Reverend Luke Powery, who's the Dean of Chapel at Duke, who's also written extensively on the spirituals, talks about those songs being the groans from the belly of the slave ship.
Yes.
And the Psalms certainly talk about human suffering, unrelieved and unrelenting. But in a way, if you've heard it too much, you kind of lose the power. How do you sort of bring it back? How do you put the flame back in the bush?
Well, for me, it helps when I hear. When I hear the music from the people who sang it the first time. So, for example, Reverend, I could blank on his name. He wrote the song "Death Has No Mercy," which is the first song that I did on my website. But he also wrote a bunch of other songs, and some of them were a few of them were recorded by Peter, Paul, and Mary. Same song, same chord, same everything, but the delivery is very, very different. And so when you find an old blues song, you know, whether it's sung by the Rolling Stones or Peter, Paul, Mary, and if you backtrack to where that song came from and listen to the person who wrote it or the first person that we know that sang it, you get a very different message. Like, for example, when the levees break, there's two versions of it, one by Memphis Minnie and Kansas Joe McCoy, and another one by Charlie Patton. Songs are different, but they have similar references. But then if you hear 60s band, I can't think of their name, sing their version of it, it's very, very different. Mm-hmm. And so you hear the pain of when the levees break, what it was like for white people to be sent up upstream so they wouldn't get flooded, or downstream or whatever, upstream. And black men having to work the levees at gunpoint to save the white town. Like, you hear that message, even though it may not be explicit, but you hear that pain that you just don't hear the same way when it's coming from, you know, a white group, for example. Unless they can, there are some white artists that do a really amazing job at trying to bring in those voices. But it's just a very, very, very different delivery.
You just have to be intentional about connecting with the pain and not necessarily the hook, you know. So, but let me switch gears a little bit, because I know that you are also known as the Snapchat Rabbi. How did you get that title?
Honestly, I don't use Snapchat as much. I still have an account, but I started using Snapchat because I was really fascinated by the platform. I couldn't figure it out because it's a platform not written for people in our age group. At the time, and I wanted to sort of figure it out. And so I thought that I would do like ask the rabbi session on Snapchat. But the problem is, if I knew who I was, I had no following, so that didn't work. Like today, it probably would, but then it was like nobody followed me. So I just started teaching Torah on Snapchat. You know, the weekly Torah portion from our Bible. And then I just sort of got a following. I used all the features to teach Torah. I wasn't just standing there looking at my screen talking. I used some of the funny features and some of the funny voice changing things. And then my following grew. And then right when I was about to give it up, because it was taking up more time than I had ever expected it to, and also I think school was about to start again, a reporter started following me and wrote about it. And then all of a sudden, my whole account just blew up. And so I think I did several interviews about being what is called now the Snapchat Rabbi.
And also, your story is out there, and I haven't left you much time with this, but but you do get a lot of questions about being a black rabbi. And I wonder what questions you wish that you weren't getting, or that people weren't making assumptions when they ask the question.
Yeah, you know, stories are important. Narratives are important. Unfortunately, for Jews of color, when many Jews who are white, or many Jews who have benefit from white privilege, run into Jews of color, or at least when Jews come into synagogues or Jewish community centers, often the first questions that get asked of them is, how are you Jewish? Or when did you convert? Very personal questions that are asked of people that they don't even know. And that's the thing that I want our communities to do better of. Like, you don't, the sense of entitlement to know who I am when I walk into a Jewish space is something that the Jewish community needs to figure out why they're doing it, and needs to do a better job of welcoming people, because what it does is it sends a message that Jews of color are not welcome.
Well, I'm glad that you offered us the opportunity and the permission to get to know you better. Rabbi Sandra Lawson, Associate Chaplain for Jewish Life and Jewish Educator at Elon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.